Good evening, everybody, and welcome. I'm impressed that we drew such a crowd, given that Uri Zohar, a much more impressive speaker than I, is speaking just a couple blocks now. So I don't know what time he scheduled
what time
this week.
Oh,
so funny! Okay. Oh, that's sweet. Okay. Let me just get.
Here's another chair right over there.
This is time card. And I do have a book for you. I'm going to give you a book.
Okay.
Thanks. You get a Mazel Tov?
Yes.
All right.
What?
Mazel Tov.
I told my sister how nice you were.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to start off a little differently this week. I'd like you to think of the most significant event in your life until now.
Oh.
And tell me how you commemorate it, how often, and what you actually do, the whole list, to commemorate that particular event. The most significant event in your life, feel free to take out a pen and write it down. The most significant event in your life up to this point, unless, of course, you can enlighten me as to significant events that are, you know, in the future, but we don't know that yet. If you do, I mean, you should be up here instead of me. And how you commemorate it, how often, and, you know, the whole list, how you commemorate it. Pick one. Pick a, it doesn't have to be the most significant, you can pick a significant, a very significant moment in your life. I'll give you an example. Start with an easy one, okay? A birthday. Okay? Your own birthday. How do you celebrate it? I'm giving you an example for a theoretical person, okay?
But
our family half birthdays are very significant because everybody in our family who gets has a half birthday receives a call from my grandmother, may she live and be well, and continue to do this for many years, in which she sings the full course of Pat Burt to you. So that's
you,
a significant event.
And 18 was exciting, but now I don't know.
So let's say you have a birthday, okay? How do you celebrate it? You get cards, you go out perhaps with friends and family, you maybe think to your mind, sometimes evaluate where you are now as opposed to where you were a year before. You might treat yourself for something, you might do nice things for somebody else. It's my birthday. You know, oh, why are they teaching the teachers in today? It's my birthday. I wanted to do something nice for everyone else. You know, like stuff like that.
Unless you're born in the summer.
Unless you're born in the summer like Beth and I are. And then we, I don't know, what do you do? I sleep late on my birthday. I use the happy birthday placemat, you know, and mug. Yeah, could you just move over a little? We can make some room. Thank you. So I'm thinking, I want to ask you again, now that you've had all this time while I was talking to think. A super significant event in your life, how often you commemorate it, and how you commemorate it. Go ahead, Tammy, start us off.
When Jerry and I met each other after about 40 years out of...
Sandy, I need you to move over, actually.
No, this way.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So Sandy and Sandy get to next to each other.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Hi, Sandy.
Okay.
Well, go ahead.
When Jerry and I met each other, and that eventually did lead to marriage, at that time was a very unusual way to meet, and we all thought the whole story was to share it.
Yeah.
Well, the way we commemorate that meeting is when we meet someone that we feel real comfortable with, we a lot of times will tell them that story.
Okay, so that's not a particular, is that a very often event that you meet someone that you're comfortable enough
maybe,
with to share the story?
Maybe a few times a year.
Okay, a few times a year, that's nice. A few times a year to commemorate it. That's a nice, significant event and a nice way to commemorate it by retelling the story. Yes.
So, when I was very, very close to my grandmother. She was my father's mother.
And when she died, it was the first time I experienced heaviness. So I decided I was not going to allow this to get me down. So every year on her yard site, well, we're a little more spread out now, but what we used to do, I used to invite everybody over, the whole family over. We used to make all her favorite foods and serve it all at the same meal. And then we would play a silly game that she and others would play. And once a month, on her day of the yard site, which was the 10th of the day, so the 10th of every month, I would make a special effort to donate stuff up in her name. And I continued to do that. I dropped off when we went to Israel, when it was a little harder to get to Dhaka, but on the 10th of every Hebrew month, I make an effort to give to Dhaka in her memory, and I think about her. And I also found, after many, many years, I found the perfume that she used to use. And I still take a little handkerchief and I douse it with the cologne and I have it in my bag, and whenever I get, okay, I can't stand my boss anymore, I can't stand my work, I just take it out.
I can't
and
relate.
I smell
no,
it.
Nobody here could relate to such an
incident. And, you know, and just, I love that. And her favorite flower is Lily of the Valley. So every time I smell it, I think about it.
Very nice. So we have, so far, we have two very different approaches.
Well,
yeah, go ahead, Mrs. Tynepot.
Well, my mother learned how to drive when she was, about 78. And she only made right turns. And she never backed up, and she couldn't park her car. But she loved driving. And every time I get into the car, I said, if Eva could do it, I could do it. Uh-huh. And so I've been driving then since then, too.
So this is such a perfect progression. You don't even realize this. We have Sandy's commemoration. I'll get to you in one moment, please. Sandy's commemoration happens as the occasion presents itself, which could happen several times a year. And then Miriam's is getting a little closer, a little more set times. We have a yearly commemoration and a monthly commemoration, and perhaps a daily commemoration, depending on how good you are. But yours is clearly a daily commemoration.
Daily.
You see this nice progression? We didn't even set this up before. Okay, yes, Mrs. Engel.
No, I was going to make a comment about Drara.
Okay.
About my mother.
You make right turns.
No,
I don't. She makes only left turns. You know, they complement each other. Okay. We're going to shelve this. We're going to take this little exercise and put it on the shelf for about 12 minutes from now. Okay? So let's open up our books to the beginning of Parshat Bo. Parshat Bo 1. And we're going to be using mostly the Nechama today, as opposed to, we're not going to look in the Chumash so much, but we will look in the Chumash a bit. I want to wish all of you who have recently purchased Nechama books today, Tichadshu, may you use it in good health and happiness, and may it bring you many, many years of learning and growing closer to Torah and understanding even greater the beauty of her approach to Torah. If you please take and pass these, there's only one sheet. It is double-sided. Sure. Since she only has a four-page piece on the beginning of Parshat Bo, I beefed it up a little bit. So, okay, here we are. No, it's for everybody. This is to compliment with an E, complement, compliment the materials. There are more coming around from this side. Okay, we're on page 178, Action-Shaped Character, the first section of Parshat Bo.
And you have Sandy here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mary, you have one?
Yes.
No, we don't need any more.
Okay. This sidra, she says, and I want to write from the second word, I just want to clarify a terminology for you. We did this last week. Don't worry. Relax. Mm-hmm. I'll hold your hands. I'll take you through the whole thing. You'll walk out. You'll say, that was an amazing class. Best day I ever had.
Really?
I'm coming back next week.
Fine.
Okay.
I promise.
Excellent. Okay. She begins by referring to a sidra. And I just wanted to clarify for you we spoke last week because one of the things that we've been addressing in these classes are certain terminologies that come up. Right? We spoke last week about a parsha p'tucha and a parsha stima, different ways to divide up the chumash. We also spoke about the chiastic structure. Remember, old King Cole was a Mary Old Soul and a Mary Old Soul was he. I had a lot of fun with that one. Okay, so today I want to start by talking to you about a sidra. What is a sidra? What? Okay, seder means order, so a sidra is part, it has something to do with order. A sidra, the sidra is the technical term to refer to the weekly Torah reading. Okay, we call it the weekly parsha. As we spoke about last week, as I mentioned, just now alluded to, we talk about our parsha p'tucha and parsha stuma. Parsha is really a topic in the Torah. You know, like I have a lot of students now, since I've been at Akiva, who are coming back to visit. They were in an answer session a couple weeks ago from Stern. They came back and visit. You ask them the question, are you in the Parsha? In the Parsha meaning, are you ready to date, right? In the Parsha. What do you mean, am I in the Parsha? Is my name in this week's Parsha? No, it's not in this week's Parsha. The Parsha meaning is that the topic of discussion at the moment, in the Parsha. Okay? I just wanted to point that out to you. It's a technical distinction, but it's an important one here. That she refers to the sidra. The sidra is the weekly Torah portion. Okay.
Why do some people call it the sidra?
It's a mispronunciation of the sidra.
Well, it's the sidra.
So, right, but sidra really is a sidra, not a sidra. But listen, either a mispronunciation or, let's say, a dialect. Okay?
The
sidra. Okay. The 15th in the order of our Sabbath readings from the Pentateuch, Pentateuch being the five books of Moses, prefix penta being five, pentagon, pentagram, okay, is the first to contain a comprehensive list of religious ordinances, of positive and negative injunctions. Guess what, folks? We're 15 weekly parshiot, weekly sedras, into the Torah. And how many mitzvahs have we read so far?
None.
Close to none. Anyone want to take a stab? Beat Milah is one that we've read already. Purvu is the second one we've read already. It's actually the first one, and Beat Milah is the second one, and there is a third one that we did read already.
Git Hanasha.
Yes. Okay. Do not eat from the Git Hanasha, from the part of the body where Yaakov was harmed when he was fighting together with the angel of Esau. So it's kind of an unusual thing. I wanted to point it out to you, and we're using this evening the Sefer HaChinuch as the basis of our study. Sefer HaChinuch was a piece that was written in the Middle Ages until very recently was considered anonymous, so we didn't know who the author is. I read very recently that they discovered who the author is, but it didn't really, it wasn't somebody that I recognized, so I didn't pursue it, so I can't really tell you that. I apologize. Sefer HaChinuch did something very unusual. Up till his time, there were several books that counted the order of the mitzvot. And those of you who were with me in the Rambam class, I don't know, was it 2 years ago already that we started, where we discussed the question of the first mitzvah in the list. How many mitzvahs are there? 613, right? But you don't know which are the 613 mitzvot. Which exactly, there's a debate. Which of all the mitzvot in the Torah are considered part of that 613 mitzvot? The Taryag. So there are a lot of books of mitzvahs that list, that list all the mitzvahs, and we had the question of, is the first mitzvah of the Torah, is the first mitzvah to believe in God? And if you remember, the question we had specifically was, how could you have a mitzvah to believe in God? Shouldn't that be a prerequisite for all of the other mitzvahs? Because if you believe in God, then you're wasting a mitzvah on it. If you don't believe in God, then why bother with having it as the first mitzvah? You need to believe in God in order to accept it as a mitzvah. It was a whole discussion that we had. It lasted a couple of weeks. I think you can get it on the internet if you're interested. There's my weekly plug for our website. So the Sefer HaChinuch did something unique in that he ordered the mitzvot not by order of importance to him, but by order of actually appearance in the Torah. So what I brought you was from his table of contents. This is source number one. And he tells you how many mitzvot are in each parashat HaShavuah, in each sedra. In Bereshit, you have Aleph. You have number one, mitzvah, priyat, uriviyat, which is what you said, puravu, to get married and have children. Number two, mitzvah, milah, which is in the parasha of Lech Lecha, the mitzvah of having a bris. Then you skip all the way to Vayishlach, where you have shalo lechol gid hanasha, not to eat the gid hanasha, that part of the leg, where Yaakov was harmed. And then he skipped to Bo El Paro. And you have mitzvahs Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Chet, Tet, Yud Aleph, Yud Bet, Yud Gimel. That's 10 already, right? Yud Dalet, Tet, Vav, Tet, Zayin, Yud Zayin, Yud Chet, that's 15. Yud Tet, Chav, Chav, Al, Chav, Gat, Chav, Gimel. How many mitzvahs do we have in one parsha all of a sudden? 20 mitzvahs, right there, in one parsha. Look in the left-hand column where I wrote Sefer HaChinuch, the first four mitzvot. Aleph, mitzvah Priya Urevia. He starts with Reishit, the Parsha Reishit. There's a mitzvah Priya Urevia, having children. Then you have Parsha told about Noach, Ein Ba Mitzvah. There are no mitzvahs in the Parsha of Noach. Then you have the mitzvah of Mila, which is in Parsha Lech Lecha. Then Min Parsha Vayera Adkan Ein Bo Mitzvah. From Parsha Vayera until this point, meaning mitzvah Gimel, which is Vayeshach, there are no mitzvahs there. Gimel Shalom Lechol Gin Hanasha. And then from here, Mikan Ad Shof Sefer Breshi in Bo Mitzvah. From here till the end of the book of Breshi, there are no more mitzvahs listed. Mishlam Sefer Breshi, we finished Sefer Breshi. Okay, we're starting Sefer Shemot. Parshat Ve'ela Shemot, Parshat Ve'era in Bo Mitzvah. First two parshas already again, we don't have any mitzvah in them. Parshat Bo El Paro, but in the parsha of Bo, Yesh Batesha Mitzvot Aseh, there are 9 positive commandments, Ve'acharishen Mitzvot Lo Taseh, 11 negative commandments, bringing us to a grand total in Parshat Bo of 20 mitzvahs. Okay, second thought question of the evening. What kind of book is this? What's it all about? Blueprint for life. What kinds of things are in it? What would you say is the majority of this book?
History.
Lessons through history, perhaps. There's another sort of major majority of this book. There are two debated majorities of this book. You have history and lessons on one hand, and on the other hand, you have a lot of mitzvahs, rules, right? Legislation, things that you have to do. Right? Okay. Did you read the article in the New Yorker? I saw on Auslander. This is my weekly plug for outside literature. Shalom Auslander evidently was a young man who grew up in Muncie, it seems in an Orthodox home. Completely bitter, horrible, thinks God is vengeful and is laughing at us. And that's why all the rules are there, so he can have fun. And he writes this whole piece and his feelings about it and his joyous break from the strictures and restrictions of Orthodox Judaism. Yeah. His joyous break from the strictures and restrictions of Orthodox Judaism. Yes. Abetted by his lovely wife. Okay. He looks at this book as a bunch of rules. It's interesting that the first perspective in this class as expressed, I don't know if that's what went through your minds, but the first one that was expressed was history. And then lessons. Mitzvot only came out after I sort of pulled them from you. Right? But really, if you look, if you would ask any person off the street what kind of book is the Torah, what's in the Torah, and they would tell you a book of laws. Right? It's a book of laws. So Rashi asks this very famous question in the first Rashi, the book of Rashi. How does this Torah, which we would think of as a book of how to lead your life and how to run your life, let's say a blueprint for life, that was really the first answer, was a blueprint for life, general. How does it start? How does it start? This blueprint for life begins with?
In the beginning.
Reshit Bara Elokim Hashemayim Et Haaretz. By the way, a completely grammatically incorrect sentence. But that's again for another time. Okay, Reshit Bara Elokim Hashemayim Et Haaretz. Rashi asks the question, he quotes Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak was not his father. Rabbi Yitzchak was a rabbi who lived in the time of the Tanaim. He was a Tana, and he is quoted in the Midrash, and he's saying as follows. He's actually quotes him here. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak says in source number 3, Lo hayat shavich la'etchila tatshara ela me'chodesh zalachem. Where should you have started the Torah? You should have started the Torah from the middle of Parshat Bo. If you'll open up your Chumashim, can we see her?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Open your Chumashim to Perek Yudbet in this week's Parsha. 12, chapter 12. I think it's 10. Page 348 and 349. This is the first mitzvah that shows up in our list of mitzvot here, not the first mitzvah in the Torah, but the first mitzvah we'll see in a minute what's unique about it. Yomer Hashem al Moshe ve'al Aaron be'aretz Mitzrayim. Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Mitzrayim le'emor, to say, with the purpose of saying the following over to the Jewish people, HaChodesh hazeh lachem losh chodeshim. Nisan is going to be the first of the month, Rishon hu lachem l'chodesh hashana, and you're going to start pointing out months. You're going to have this new thing called Rosh Chodesh. And you're going to eat ice cream, and you're going to wear white shirts, and you're not going to do malacha for the ladies, and it's going to be a ball for everybody. Rosh Chodesh. Okay? Send out flyers.
I mean, I have a good time on Rosh Chodesh, but I do something.
I know you have a very nice time on Rosh Chodesh with all your ladies in your Rosh Chodesh club. That's a great thing. I was never invited to your Rosh Chodesh club. We should talk about this afterwards. Okay. So Rosh Chodesh is a new thing for the Jewish people, only for the Jewish people. Why is Rosh Chodesh so important? Why do they need to all of a sudden start marking time? Because what is he about to tell them? He turns the page. You don't have to know by heart. What? What?
How do you know it's Nisan?
Because it's this month that we're talking in. That's a whole other thing.
Okay.
Daveru al kol adai Yisrael. He says, speak to all the Jewish people saying this following. Lay more. Be'asur l'chodesh hazeh. On the 10th of this month. Ve'yikhu lachem lahem ish selavet avot selabayit. Every person should take a set to their house. Every person should take a lamb. Every Jewish person should take a lamb and do what, Rafi? Tie it outside the house, right? I heard that the creches had a... Yeah, I missed that. It was before... Well, no, but I heard you got before the summer, that it was a while ago that you got it. If you had it again. Oh, every year you do it. So every year you're all invited over to the creches.
We're all invited.
But not this year.
We don't bring it for a
carbon. Oh, she doesn't bring it for a carbon. Okay, but you will this year. Because the Mashiach is coming, the Beis Hamikdash will be there, unless you all bring them for a carbon. There's the chef. Okay. You're going to take these lambs. Everyone's going to take these lambs. What?
I said you're so passive.
Achakelo b'chol yom sheyavo. You don't have your bag packed?
I'm not slim out there.
Your bag isn't packed?
It's always packed.
You're ready to go out the door. No, my bag isn't packed either, but that's okay. I have everything there I would need. I have a charge card too, right? Okay. All right. That's all you need. Okay. Be'imi mad habayit. And then he starts going on. You're going to take this lamb. You're going to tie it up. And on the 14th of the month, you're going to do this. And you're going to put the blood. And you're going to all eat together. So why do we all of a sudden need this mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh?
No one to do
everything. Okay? And most importantly, for the initial time in which it was given to know when you're going to leave Mitzrayim. You have to know when Rosh Chodesh is so that you can know when the night is that you're supposed to leave Mitzrayim. Right? The night of the 14th. That's a pretty significant event, right?
The 14th
is pretty important. Rosh
Chodesh?
No, you need to know Rosh Chodesh so you can count 14 days to get to your important event. So Rashi, all the way at the beginning of the book of Bereishit, says, listen, this is the first mitzvah that's given to the Jewish people. He's brilliant. Of course he's brilliant. He's Rashi. This is the first mitzvah that's given to the Jewish people. The Torah is the book for the Jewish people. Shouldn't the Torah begin with the first mitzvah that was given to the Jewish people? Kasha, good question.
Why does
it? So why doesn't it?
What makes this the first mitzvah? Isn't it the first mitzvah whatever came after the Milah?
The first mitzvah that's commanded to Jewish people as a whole.
As a whole.
To Jewish people as a nation. Until now, it was individuals and then to your descendants. But this is something that's really commanded to the Adat Yisrael, to the congregation of Israel. So he says, I'm going to start from the beginning again. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak said, Lo haya tzarich le'tzchil et ha'Torah ela me'chodesh zelachem. The Torah should have begun from the mitzvah of ha'chodesh zelachem, the mitzvah of ha'chodesh. Why? She'hi mitzvah rishonah she'nitzavu by Yisrael. Because that is the first commandment that the Jewish people were commanded. So why did the Torah begin with Bereishit, with the story of the creation of the world? And he answers an answer that's going to blow you away. I mean, it's tangential to the class, but I'm going to do it anyway. Mishum koach ma'ashav yigivamo, because there's a pasuk in Tehillim that says, the strength, the power of his deeds he had formed to his nation, latet lahem nachalak oyim, to give them the portion of the other nation. That if the nations of the world say to the Jewish people, Lishimatem, you are robbers. Shekivashem Artok Shiva Goyim, because you captured, you stole the land of the seven nations. Hamam Imahem, they, the Jews, answer back to them.
Back to them. Well, the whole land belongs to God. He is the one who created it. He gave to whoever he thinks deserves it. According to his will, he originally gave it to you, but according to his will, he's now taking it from you and giving it to, giving her to us. So, Rashi, I mean, I just want to...
We should memorize this Rashi.
Rashi lived in the time of the First Crusades. Okay, in the time of the First Crusades, in France, which is where Rashi lived, you have all these Christians who decided what a great thing it would be to go to the Holy Land and free the Holy Land from the infidels. The infidels being the Ottoman Turks, the Muslims who were in charge of the land at that time. Now, then came a very smart priest in France and said, you know, here we are going all the way, taking this treacherous journey over to the Holy Land to free the Holy Land from the infidels, when lo and behold, we have infidels here, i.e. Jewish people, right in our backyard. Therefore, it became a terribly dangerous time for the Jewish people. And we say kinos about it on Tisha B'Av, about all the terrible things that happened to the Jews during the Crusades. Rashi was a sure rabbi, a congregational rabbi during this time. And to get up in front of his congregation and say that the land of Israel looks like it's not ours, and it looks like we're going through all these difficulties for no reason, but really part of God's plan is to give the land of Israel, to start his parish on the Torah like this, to give the land of Israel to us, I'm getting killed. Okay, that's tangential, though, because really the whole point I'm building up is the mitzvah thing, okay? But there's no, the mitzvah for the Jewish people doesn't show up until the mitzvah, until Parsha Bo, which is where we are now. Okay? Can we redirect, refocus? Back to Nechama?
Wow.
I couldn't leave that tangent.
He's saying that it began with Bereshit because of this?
It began with Bereshit to prove that the world belongs to God because he created it. He could give the land of Israel to whoever he wants, and the one who is ultimately destined to get the land of Israel is the Jewish people. Okay. Back to, we're still in the first paragraph of, but it'll go fast, you'll see. Okay. The previous subject matter in the Torah has been mainly of a narrative character, meaning stories, moral lessons, occasional precept being woven into the fabric of the story. We had three mitzvahs, as we mentioned earlier in the class, and they're mentioned in the footnote on the bottom of the page. Indeed, Rashi's first words in this commentary to the Torah in the form of a question as to why the Torah didn't begin with the first mitzvah given to the people of Israel. A mitzvah which occurs in this week's Sedra. There are no less than 20 mitzvahs in our Sedra according to Rambam's enumeration and according to the Sefer HaChinuch as well, as we saw. The first mitzvah is that of sanctifying the new moon, Rosh Chodesh, followed by a detailed list of Passover ordinances which surround that historic festival of redemption with seemingly irksome domestic duties and laborious legal minutiae. And here's where we come to our original activity of the evening. We continue. What was the Torah's purpose in framing so many precepts? Why is the Jewish way of life distinguished for these numerous commands, negative and positive, that govern its every facet? In short, why do we have these mitzvahs? 20 mitzvahs in the Parsha of Bo, talking about the minutiae, the legal minutiae of eating the Korban Pesach, and you can't leave it over till morning, and you're not allowed to break the bones, and you can share it with other people, but each, like, well, everybody has to have some. You have to eat it till you're full. Like, there are all these different mitzvahs in there. What do we need all of these mitzvahs for? Yeah.
So we'll all do it the same.
But we're not automatons. Right? I think that there could perhaps be something beyond that. And the Sefer HaChinuch says that there is something even deeper than that. The unknown author of the Sefer HaChinuch, a work listing 613 divine mitzvot in their order of occurrence in the Torah, attempts to supply a reason for each of the mitzvahs. Sefer HaChinuch has set up in a very interesting way. Within each paragraph, he defines the mitzvah, tells you the source where it's from, tells you the halachas relating to the mitzvah. Good to see you. Gives you the reason for the mitzvah, which is very unusual in a book of mitzvahs, and then tells you who it applies to whom it applies and when and where. In other words, if this is a mitzvah that's relevant only to women in the land of Israel, it will say, he will write that at the end of the mitzvah. So he, to supply reasons for mitzvahs, that's like a big thing. That's an innovative approach. This 13th century Jewish philosopher develops his main thesis and explanation on one of the ceremonial details governing partaking of the Paschal Lamb, mitzvah number 16. And I brought you the full Hebrew source on the back of the page that you have in front of you, partly because I was afraid that the class would be too short with the pages that she had, but partly also because I mean, it's, well, her translation is excellent. It's,
I mean, it's the best translation, but it is a little lofty language sometimes. So I will go through it. Please feel free to either read it in English on your own or whatever, follow with me, either way, both ways. And I'm going to start a little earlier than she does. So we've got a couple of sentences that I think are great. Okay, Mishar Sheha Mishra, here are the reasons of the Mishra for why you're not allowed to break the bones on the Karban Pesach. These Korni say Mitzrayim. Remember the miracles from Mitzrayim. Kloshek, Tavnu Bachay. Well, like we wrote with all those other mitzvahs. The Gan Zegeza Min HaShorosh HaNiskar. This is a the trunk of the tree of one of these roots that we're talking about. She'ein Kavod Livnei Melachim Yotzei Eretz Ligura HaTamot L'Shavam Tichladim. Why are you not allowed to break the bones of the Korban Pesach? Because it's not the way princes eat. Princes and advisors and cabinet members do not chew on the marrow to, you know, get it out from the inside. That's not how they eat. So that's why we shouldn't eat that way either. Lo ya'od la'shol kacha, ki im la'aniye ha'am haru'evim. Who does it? Only, and this is, I mean, this is a custom in our family to break the bones and eat the inside out. I don't know if you do this also, but it comes from a long, many years of that's because you don't have anything else to eat because you're poor. And that's where you get, it tastes good because you are conditioned to taste good. But if you think about it, what you're doing, it's a little gross, right? I mean, to me, it's my favorite part. You know, you make this slip pea soup with the marrow bones in it, and I mean, it's delicious. Okay, Beth is sitting here shivering. Sorry about that.
I'm a former vegetarian.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, sorry about that. Okay. So he's explaining, he's describing that's the way hungry people eat. But we are kings on the night of the Seder, and this is not the way we're going to eat the night of the Seder. So you're not allowed to break the bones of Korban Pesach. This is how it was in the beginning when we first came in to be, and this is where she starts her translation. Our first appearance in the world's history, in the role of God's chosen people as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, took place at this season. And in every year at the same time, this Yetzirah Mitzrayim, coming out of Mitzrayim, and the Korban Pesach, that whole thing started our entrance into the world as princes. Therefore, every year when we commemorate it, we have to behave according to our station, so to speak. And from what we're doing and the image that we present by doing this, that will establish within our hearts this concept forever. In other words, if we behave like kings, we will then internalize this concept of being like kings. And then he's writing the whole book, by the way, is a letter to his son. So he says, don't start asking me, he says to his son, don't start asking me why Hashem commands us so many mitzvahs to remember this miracle. Wouldn't it be enough with one way, one commemoration to remember this event? We wouldn't forget it. That, he says, you should know. He's speaking to his son. You're not speaking to me out of wisdom. This is youthful indiscretion that's causing you to speak this way. And indeed, around this table, if you think and you look down at what you wrote about how you commemorate events, most of the time we don't just commemorate it with one thing. There are other times when you remember your mother. Exactly. But in addition to just getting into the car. You know, we don't just take a significant event. And there are other times, Andy, that you remember that wonderful meeting, you know, when you met Jerry. And, like, other than the times when you just tell the story. Like, you told us of the several times. You can't just commemorate a significant event with a one-time thing. It doesn't work that way. You need a list of 20 things in which to commemorate the significant event. He says, listen to me with your intellect. Listen very carefully. I'm going to teach you the benefit, the underlying benefit, how you will gain from all of the mitzvahs in the Torah. This is the secret to the mitzvahs. You ready?
die.
You should know. Yeah, Jamnif al Kafifulato. Man behaves according to his actions. Vilibo v'chol machshavotav tamid achar ma'asav shu'oshekahem in tovo ra. Man behaves in a certain particular way, and his thoughts and heart follow his actions, whether for good or for bad. Afilu rasha gamar. Even if you have a complete evil person, bilvavo in his heart, he's completely evil. B'chol yetzer machshavot libo rak rakol hayom. He's totally corrupt. If for some reason all of a sudden he is aroused to devote his life, a minute of his life to Torah, even if it's not l'shem shamayim, afilu l'shem shamayim miyad yinatel hatov, right away, all of a sudden when he starts doing it, even not for the right reason, you're going to lean in that direction from doing it not for the right reason, all of a sudden you start doing it for the right reason. If you're, in theory, a high school student who together hangs out with friends who bench, and you don't normally bench, and you sort of start benching with your friends because that's what they're all doing, chances are when you get home a few weeks later, you're going to start benching because that's part of your habit. Mm-hmm. And then you might even start understanding what you're saying, and then it'll mean something to you, even though you originally started benching only to be part of the crowd. Mm-hmm. How about it, right? Mm-hmm. By doing these actions, he will destroy the Yetzirah. I would like underline this and like highlight it and put it on your wall in like needlepoint or something. That your heart follows your actions. If you want to feel something, you have to do something. You have to behave the way you want to feel. And then the feeling will come. The opposite is also true. If a person is a complete tzaddik, his heart is straight and pure. All he wants is Torah mitzvot. If he'll start regularly involving himself in foolish pursuits, for instance, we'll say, for example, that the king forced him, and he put him in like some kind of bad job. If all his doings the whole day are in that bad job, he will very surely, after some time, turn from a complete tzaddik to a complete rasha. It's known and true manner, that man does everything according to what he does, that his heart follows what he does. This is a great, a song. Betty made a song out of this, and they sing this at every NCSY Shabbat. When they sang it when I was in NCSY, and I didn't think that they still sang it, but they do still sing it. He says, Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is a quote from Chazal, Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakod Ez Yisrael. God wanted the Jewish people to be good people. That's why he gave them all the Torah mitzvot. Because all of the mitzvot are to prepare our souls, to make us into the kind of person who will benefit immensely and completely. Because from doing these good actions, we become good and merit having Olam Haba. And Chazal hinted to this in saying, and in the second column, Kol mi sheyesh lo mezuzah b'tzvitcho, b'tzitzit b'vidjo, tzvim b'rosho, muzkach lo shelo yachta. The Chazal tell us that anyone who has a mezuzah on his door, and tzitzit on his clothing, and tefillin on his head, it's promised that he's not going to sin. L'fi she'elu mitzvot t'midiyot. Because these are constant mitzvot that you're doing all the time, b'nif al behen tamid. And you're always doing them. I'll tell you, I just read very recently in a book by Gila Mandelson, her new edition of Outside, Inside, Outside. She has a section on hair covering. And she says that when a married woman covers her hair, it reminds her that she has a new, there's something that's newly permissive to her, but only in certain circumstances. That the hat, just the pressure of it on your head almost, controls you. Reminds you that you are now a married woman, and yes, certain things are permitted, but you need to now behave in a more mature way. It was very interesting for Seth, but it fit in very nicely here. He says, "Lachen atarei gam rei, you'll see mamalachtecha v'askecha, see what you do, p'yachareim timshach v'atalo timshachem, because your heart will go after what you do and not the other way around. V'al yavtichecha yitzecha lomar, don't let your yitzahara promise you, shnei, acharei heyot libi shalim v'tanim v'ma not halotim, they'll have shed yishli yatanig, v'afamim v'tanugim v'ashim. Don't let your yitzahara come into and say, okay, you know, in a few years I'll be a tzaddik. So until I become a tzaddik, what's the harm in dilly-dallying a little in this stuff? Lashavet bashvakim urechavot, to sit at the mall and in the streets, lechaytim alechim, to hang out with the scoffers, lezabet tzachot, to scorn things, lechaytet elo adrim she'in rabim alehem ashamot lechataot. These aren't things that you bring korbanos for. They're not talking about, like, big sins. Halo gam milevav kemohim. My heart is like theirs. Ketaniya vam imetzneihem. I'm a tzaddik anyway. You know, I'm going to be a tzaddik, so my pinky is still wider than their waist. That's not going to, you know, if I do a little bit with them now, that's not going to convince me to do anything terrible. Albini, he says, don't, my child. Be careful, pentilachid berishtan, so that you're not captured by them. Rabim shatu mitoch kach kos tar el tam. Many have drunk thus from such a poisonous cup. Ve'atat nafshecha tatzil, save your soul. Now don't wonder, now that we've spoken about this, don't wonder why there are so many mitzvos to remember the miracles of Mitzrayim. Shehem amud gadol b'torotinu, which are a great pillar in our Torah. Kibirvot ashakenu b'hem, by us doing them so much, we will become them. So he spoke specifically with breaking of the bones, that if you, you know, every time that you're careful about breaking the bones, that you remember what a princely nation we are and how we are royalty, et cetera, et cetera. But the same said, I mean, with all of the mitzvot of Yetziat Mitzrayim, that this is a major mitzvah to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim. You know, even women have this mitzvah to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim every single day. But you can't just remember, you can't just expect to remember it. You have to do things to remember it. So we daven in order to remember it. You say the end, the Azrat of Atenim at the end, right before Shemona Esrei. Even if you don't really have time to daven very much, if you're just making Shemona Esrei, tag on Azrat of Atenim before it also, so that you have this mitzvah of Yetziat Mitzrayim, because otherwise there's no way to remember it. It's not going to pop into your mind. You have to keep doing these things to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is a fundamental part, because that's what made us a nation. Page 180, I'm in the second paragraph. In other words, religious training should not proceed from mind to deed, from reason to action. The educator need not appeal to the understanding of his charge through oral persuasion in the hope that conviction will ultimately lead to the appropriate actions. Right? You're not going to convince somebody. You can't try to convince someone to do the mitzvah. Rather, as Rambam observes in his introduction to Avot, a man should cultivate good deeds in order to improve his character, and it's too evil deeds for undesirable traits to disappear. Why should you do good? To be good. Why should you avoid bad? To be good. Know that good and bad qualities can only be cultivated by repetitive acts. If those actions are good, we acquire a praiseworthy trait. If bad, an undesirable one. Should we doubt the efficacy of this mode of education, if you're not sure this is going to work, let's for a minute recall those concentration camp officials who had to carry out the orders of their masters. Remember how ordinary folk who were neither angels nor devils became brutalized as a result of the brutal preoccupations to which they had been appointed. This is exactly the example that the Sefer HaChinuch gives.
I remember that happened.
Yes. Though that you've told me about that. Mm-hmm. Though they might have at the beginning experienced revulsion, habit and custom soon got the better of them, and the words of the author of the Sefer HaChinuch were borne out, that action shaped character. Mm-hmm. But the opposite is also true. If you recognize that the preoccupation with evil pursuits can brutalize human character, why can't you believe that good deeds and the performance of the mitzvot can make a person good also? One objection might be raised to this mode of character training, emphasizing the importance of habit and performance. What could be a downside? If we're focusing just on doing the mitzvot, just do, and then the emotions will come afterwards, what's a downside to that? Right, it's completely empty practice. Demoralizing effect of perfunctory religious practice where the spirit is sacrificed to the letter. All you're focusing on is, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing, as opposed to infusing belief and thought into it. This is alluded to by the Navi Yeshayahu when he denounces contemporaries. He says, "Vajihi yiratam oti mitzvah elokim lumada." They fear of me is only a precept of man learned by rote. They're taught to fear me. And I have to tell you quite honestly, we are doing a huge disservice to our students, particularly on the high school level. We as a community of educators, that we teach our students mitzvahs, 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 and you have to fear God, and you have to love God, and you have to believe in God, and you have to do this, and you have to dress this way, and you have to speak this way, and you have to act this way. And we don't tell them, we don't explain to them what it's all about. First of all, many educators don't serve as examples to them. But secondly, we don't explain to them what are you supposed to feel, and how do I feel that? Yeah.
Why can't there be time for both?
There could be. I'm just stating a fact, a reality. Of course there should be. I mean, I and many of my colleagues work very hard at putting that into our classroom education and instruction. But as a community of educators, including myself within the larger community of educators, we are lax in this area. And as parents, I would say very often also, you know, it's a very fine line to walk between encouraging our children to daven and shul and forcing them to. And when you force them and they don't want to, and then they're just doing it because you're making them, but they don't feel it. It's like a very,
it has to start way before high school.
Yes, definitely. And which is why I'm only talking about high school educators. Early childhood educators, of course, are not remiss at all in this area and doing wonderful and infusing the love of Judaism. And that's really what it is. There's unfortunately some gap though between early childhood and high school, but that's again for another time. Okay. You see, Yeshayahu's complaint would seem to apply though to a generation saturated in Jewish tradition and practice. There, the danger existed of religious ceremonies degenerating into mere lip service, as indeed the prophet indicates had happened. But where the bond of tradition and the legacy of generations were in danger of disappearance, a return to Jewish practice and precepts constitute the elementary first step in remedying the situation. In other words, in a community like ours, where our connection to Judaism is strong, then this is a valid point to make, that perhaps we as a community are going through the rituals and the rites as lip service without the emotion. But in a community that is not yet at that point, where there is neither emotion nor practice, then the practice is the necessary first step to get to before infusing the rest of it. Unlike Yeshayahu, the prophet Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah finds in his generation that even elementary Jewish religious practice is lacking. Zahagoya shelo yishamu b'kol Hashem elokav lo akumusar avdaha amunav nechortam epihem. They don't listen to the voice of the Lord, it's God, or accept correction, faith is perished, it's cut off from their mouth. Malbim interprets each phrase in the above citation to refer to a specific flaw in Israel's conduct. The first line, they haven't listened to the voice of the Lord, refers to their lack of religious conviction. The second line, they haven't accepted correction, refers to the punishment they've suffered, but the lesson of which they had not taken to heart. Faith is perished from their heart and is cut off from their mouth, but they have not even the practice of ancestral custom to their credit. Nothing. Zero. Zip. Nada. Such a generation requires training in practical Jewish precept, an observance at least of the letter, even before the spirit, and according to the findings of the Sefer HaChinuch, that action shaped character and performance out of wrong motives eventually lead to the right ones. The order is ancient indeed and was followed by our ancestors on Mount Sinai when they said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen, putting performance first and conviction afterwards. Accordingly, it would have been quite inadequate for the Torah to have perpetuated the message of the Exodus from Egypt by calling on us merely to recount the story. Profound implications of this event through which the Almighty acquired us as his people, which we spoke about last week, by the way, warranting its being referred to in the opening words of the Ten Commandments, were engraved on the historic memory of the Jewish people through countless symbols and precepts applying to every facet of our existence. I mean, we say every morning, say Shema, why do we wear tzitzis? You know, why do we say Kiddush? Zecher is the other time. This is constantly in our lives. We involve passive performance for every age group, every station of life, at all times and places, at home and abroad. Their spiritual impact is meant to be irresistible, since action shapes character. So my bracha for you this week, as I end every week, is that we should have the strength to do the right actions, even if they are for the wrong reasons, and that our heart should truly follow after our actions in a positive way. Make it a good week, Shavuot Tov.